Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and p.m. We are also rebroadcast Monday mornings at 1 a.m. and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And I want to let you know that most every interview that we have been doing over the last few years, unless you go to the website and unless you take a listen to the archive, you don't get the whole interview. And what I mean by that is I've made reference to the afterview. The afterview is that portion of the interview that came after the radio show ended. We continued talking, so you can continue listening. Just go to the respective interviews and take a listen to what else our guests had to say. Like our guest today, who is in studio with me, and I'm very happy to have him here. His name is Ben Werner. He is an entrepreneur here in the Santa Barbara area. He is also the initiator, if you will, the creator of the Sustainable with the Sustainable Living Research Initiative. And Ben, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
My pleasure, Richard.
You and I, of course, we've known each other on and off for, well, for a few years. We've had the great pleasure of sitting in on talks that Swami Vididhishananda gave. Then we've had him on our program as well. But you and I chatted, of course, initially about some of the ways in which we could make a difference in terms of cleaning up the environment and having a more sustainable life, if you will, where the things that we do don't detract from our environment and maybe, if not neutral, might even add something to our environment. And that's what we're going to talk about today in regards to this, which is something that I had not heard of before, but I like what I'm hearing thus far, the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, creating a model regulatory framework. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. Now, you had an event back in September of 2014. And if you don't mind, I'd actually like to maybe go back to that event, and maybe you can share with us some of the things that came out of that gathering on the UCSB campus.
Sure. Yeah. So we had an event in September at UCSB on the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, and the objective of that event was to bring into the same room local government officials, staff officials such as building officials, city planners, county planners, and so forth, to really hear the objective of this initiative and to invite these various folks from various disciplines and positions of authority in our local government to give their input into how we can implement it. And at that point, we had already made some significant progress in towards implementation of the initiative in the county and in some of our local cities, the city of Santa Barbara, the city of Goleta. And it was certainly a challenge for me personally to get everyone there that I wanted to in one room. We had, we were successful. We had city council members from the city of Goleta. We had building officials from actually a few different counties, including Santa Barbara and some other counties from the state, from throughout the state of California. And it was fairly unprecedented from the feedback we heard that we had that many folks from so many different areas of local government really convening in one room to talk about something that would touch all of their respective departments. And what I mean by that is that the purpose of the Sustainable Living Research Initiative is to create a pathway through building code, zoning code, and health codes to permit more sustainable development options in our communities, things like natural building materials and methods, gray water systems, composting toilets, and zoning code matters such as, for example, being able to implement and construct an agricultural village on agriculturally zoned land, as opposed to, for example, you know, a large single-family farmhouse. So the vision is really through having a pathway that touches all these different areas of code, we can really build examples of sustainable human development that are that really are well above the status quo of what we're seeing under the guise of green building and so forth.
Well, it seems to me a rather monumental task when you start thinking about working within the existing framework of government and all of the various agencies that you need to go through. I mean, the running joke about Santa Barbara is that if you want to build something, plan on 7 to 10 years mm-hmm. to just to get through all the permitting processes.
Yeah.
And you're talking about actually working within this framework of what's already there to implement some of these sustainable living processes, if you will, in order to bring about, again, I think maybe it's best put, a more harmonious relationship between man and nature, if mm-hmm. you will, yep. and our environment.
Yeah, it is a monumental task, really. And I wouldn't be undertaking it if I didn't have some really good feedback from our local government and the community that this is something that we can accomplish. And most of what people have been doing in, let's just call it sustainable living research, things like gray water systems, various aspects of ecological design, have happened beneath the radar, meaning unpermitted, mm-hmm. For the very reason that you state, that it can be very challenging to do things that are outside of the box within the system of regulations. And I myself was one of those people. I built my home in downtown Santa Barbara in a fairly unconventional way. I live in a yurt. I have a bathhouse, which is a timber-framed clay straw earthen plaster bathhouse with full gray water systems, a couple of different kinds of composting toilets, both indoors and outdoors, and set into, I should say, an integral part of a permaculture food garden. So our wastewater actually becomes part of the nutrient stream and soil building design of a fairly productive food garden. So what I discovered, however, when my home project became, at the time, seemingly very unfortunately, an enforcement case for an unpermitted dwelling with the city of Santa Barbara, what I discovered when I really reached out transparently to the building official at the time and to share with him what we had been doing and why and how we had been giving tours to the community for educational purposes of on site, what I discovered was that the building official was really quite interested and keen to learn more about what we were doing. And as he came on for tours of our project and subsequently brought other city officials with him, such as the city planner, for example, the general feedback we had was that whereas personally these folks really appreciated what we were doing, saw the merit of it, and would have liked to have been able to permit it fully in principle, there was not a regulatory structure in place to permit things that arguably should be researched, such as the composting toilet, for example. There are certain unknowns that we have there in terms of soil and groundwater and so forth. So when I discovered that, well, there's a desire in the party officials to support these kinds of things, but we don't have the regulatory tool in place, I decided, well, let's go about, with the full cooperation of everyone involved, including government, let's go about the process of creating that regulatory tool. And so far, we've been really successful in a couple of just sort of milestones I'll share, just so you get a sense of what I mean by that is again, this initiative has a zoning component, has a building code component, has a health code component. In the city of Goleta, the new draft zoning code of the city now incorporates its own a unique section on the Sustainable Living Research Initiative for zoning. So this is unprecedented. The city is actually fairly proud of this, and we expect that it'll be included in the final zoning code. In the county, the planning commission voted this initiative onto the county work program about a year ago, February 2014. So these are a couple of the milestones we passed with local government in bringing this initiative closer into fully implemented code, and I think we'll be successful in doing that. And I think the other piece of it, of course, is of course the actual projects well beyond, you know, my home project. That's not at all the motivation. It's that we can do potentially much larger projects in Santa Barbara that are enabled by this and will really hopefully set an example for human integrated ecological design, human centered ecological design. I would say that we just haven't seen, at least above the radar, of in the public spotlight and in compliance with local government, that can really set the bar much higher even than what has been happening beneath the radar.
Seems to me like this falls under the same category, if you will, as back in the early beginnings of the 21st century with the internet and all of the various things that were happening on the internet, various crimes, if you will, that you could say were being committed, except that at that time we had no laws governing the internet and its uses because it was still so new. There was no legislation. Whereas we're sort of in the same boat here with sustainable living in terms of the types of buildings we can use, the types of plumbing, and as you say, the various types of waste disposal on all those levels that would be more sustainable for ourselves and our environment, just because there aren't any regulations, there are no laws governing this because it's so new in one sense.
Well, unfortunately, the laws and regulations that do exist tend to dissuade the use of some of these things.
They're prohibited.
Yeah. You know, if you're drawing an analogy with the internet, I think the most obvious analogy from my perspective is the internet, not that long ago, you know, 100 decades ago, was kind of like the building codes back in the Wild West. They basically, the building codes didn't exist. People just built their home, and it's not an issue if it's your own home and you're living in it, and if it burns down, it's your own downfall, and the sheriff knows that perfectly well.
Yeah, it's your downfall.
But when people started to build, you know, build in more suburban and urban areas and resell their homes, then there became an obvious need to have certain standards such that if you bought a building, you knew it was safe as per, you know, per fire and earthquake and other things. Yeah. So the origin of these regulations for public health and safety are well founded, and it's good we have them. But that was, you know, that was 100 years ago or so when a lot of these codes became instituted. Yeah. And what's happened since then is they've become so progressively regulated and, quite frankly, in many cases, influenced by the building materials industry that they're more biased towards a certain way of doing things than biased towards promoting innovation in certain areas where we need to innovate. So we really, you know, need to have absolute respect and appreciation for what the codes have done for us in terms of safety, structural safety, fire safety. But I think it's time for us to find a way to synthesize our need for research and innovation with our need for fundamental safety in our structures.
We basically need to upgrade.
We need to upgrade. We at least need a patch, if not a full upgrade. And if, you know, at the very least, this initiative is a patch. It's basically saying, okay, if we've got property owners or developers and who want to do something innovative, and we've got a community that, you know, that around that potential piece of property that supports the concept of what the property owner developer wants to do, then with this initiative, we have a legal pathway to permit it.
Yeah.
If the conditions are there, you know, this is not an incentive to force people to do things more sustainably. We have those initiatives always being developed, coming down from Sacramento in our codes anyway. This is really for people who are so far ahead of the curve in terms of how they want to do things or what they want to experiment with, that their only option in the current system is to do it under the radar and illegally.
Yeah.
So if we give those folks a chance to do it legally and in the public spotlight and in partnership with you know, professional architects and builders potentially and research institutions to, you know, to actually test things like gray water systems and combs and toilets and actually apply science to it, then, you know, then I think we'll get something that's actually a lot better than just, you know, what, you know, what folks are doing beneath the radar.
It's, in a manner of speaking, you could, taking a part of the title here, it would actually be living research. It's right out there, and they're doing it, and they're doing it out in the public. They're doing it in front of everyone, and we're going to see if it's going to work or not.
Right.
I mean, there's one thing that I know has been mentioned on numerous occasions by some folks, specifically here on the Central Coast, is every time it rains. You know, especially if we get a lot of rain over the short period of time, and all that water is not gathered and collected and put into cisterns and water storage facilities. It basically runs down the street into the storm drains and then right back out into the ocean, which is, of course, where it came from in the first place. But if we were just to collect it right before it got to the ocean, you know, if there was a way to do that, and I know that there is a way to do it, we just haven't done it yet. Then our water problems would be virtually over, in a manner of speaking, because it doesn't take a lot of rainwater to fill up a storage container. I mean, I heard of one guy who has a 600-gallon cistern above ground, and he has designed into it these flaps, multiple flaps around it, so that when the marine layer rolls in, all of the condensation that's generated flows into the cistern. And this guy was able to refill his cistern in like 3 or 4 months with the marine layer, with just the marine layer. I mean, folks, how do you think some of these plants that don't get regular watering from rainfall, how do you think they're staying green? They have adapted to this whole process with what we call the marine layer rolling in, that moisture, and they take it in through the leaves and the branches and so forth. And that's how they're staying alive, because they've adapted. We need to do the same kind of thing. I mean, if we're in the middle of a drought, you would think that we would use all means at our disposal to try to alleviate the shortfall. You know,
sure.
It just makes sense. By the same token, and I of course heard this in the 70s about solar energy. Oh, it's just so expensive. It's just too expensive to really research. It's just, and it's like, and my first thought even then was, and the longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to get. And we waited and we waited. And in a matter of, in certain areas, some places they're still waiting. I don't know what they're waiting for. I don't know how much more research we need to do. There is the flip side, and this is kind of what I want to talk to you about in regards to this initiative. The flip side is, what does it take to produce one of these photovoltaic cells? You know, what's the process? What contaminants are being created through that process? And I'm not asking you to answer that question, but I know that these are issues now that are now being addressed. People are thinking like this. But I'm wondering about how much disinformation some folks are getting who might be pushing back against some of these new regulations, some of this sustainable living thinking, if you will, saying, no, we don't need to add this stuff. Everything is fine the way it is. You people are like Chicken Little and the sky is falling and there isn't a problem. This is just a cyclical issue with the planet. And I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm curious as to if you've had any pushback from folks, whether it be within governmental agencies or just from the public who they don't want to see these kinds of things because they're afraid of I don't know what.
I'll tell you where some of the challenges have been. So just to clarify, you know, with respect to solar panels, for example, the general thrust of the Sustainable Living Research Initiative is not so much related to solar panels and more the, I would say that the technological aspect of, say, energy efficiency or energy generation, it's more to do with, and thematically more to do with what it takes for the human element to be integrated with an ecosystem. So a solar panel is great in that, it, you know, you use less fossil fuels to generate your energy, hopefully. But, you know, you can have a home that's run by solar panels sitting on a piece of land that has no mutually beneficial ecological function with the land that it's sitting on, whether we're talking about hydrologically, habitat for other species, soil health, and so forth. So again, nothing wrong with solar panels. Obviously, we need to, you know, develop our the sustainability of our energy use by every, you know, reasonable means we can. But just thematically, I want to clarify that the SLRI, the Sustainable Living Initiative, is really more about the functional integration of the human element or the human layer with an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting to the matter of where we've had some challenges or conflict in this. Most of our land use battles presently, in especially in the Santa Barbara County, are basically characterized by being in one of two camps or one or two parties. And those two parties are, you're either a landowner or a developer, and you want to develop your land in more or less in a way as we have done, and it basically involves reducing or destroying some ecosystem functionality. There may be some mitigation measures that you're offering to counterbalance to those, but generally, most of the development that has been done and is being proposed represents some kind of diminishment of ecosystem functionality. So that's one party. The other party is you're either an environmentalist / conservationist / preservationist person or group, and you're fighting development and trying to keep people out of ecosystems or preserve or restore ecosystems at some current or to some previous level of functionality. So that's basically the battle. That's basically the landscape into which, you know, I've entered
mm-hmm.
with this concept. And whenever you enter in a two-party system, people ask you, well, which party are you in? And they want to figure out whether you're a friend or an enemy.
Yeah.
And the reality is, as I see it at least with the SLRI, is that we're really establishing a third party, which is neither non-sustainable development on the one hand, nor pure conservation / preservation without humans on the other hand. The problem I have with the two-party system, as I like to call it sometimes for the dramatic effect, is that neither of those two options, neither of those two visions actually represents a future for humanity on the planet. If we're just destroying ecosystems, we're obviously going to be destroying ourselves eventually. And if we're just keeping people out of ecosystems in order to keep them, you know, safe, well, humans aren't part of that design. So by definition, humans are not part of that design. So what we need to do, this third party is, I call it sometimes, is human-centered ecological design, which implies that the human is benefiting from a functional ecosystem and the ecosystem is benefiting from the way in which the human aspect or the human element, residential, agricultural, whatever, is integrating or is relating to the rest of the ecosystem. So to answer your question finally, where I've had most of my pushback has actually been more from the preservation conservation aspect, and it hasn't been a huge challenge. It's been a challenge though, and I think it's partly because the folks who have fought to protect land have really been the underdogs,
mm-hmm.
right? And they've really been fighting an uphill battle. And just like with building codes, you know, we need to be grateful for the efforts that we're standing on. Everything would be paved over by now if it wasn't for, you know, wasn't for land protection
right.
initiatives and
yeah.
groups. But so to come in and propose, you know, for me to come in and propose, well, here's an initiative that would enable development in some way, you know, it might sound to an environmentalist that I'm in the other camp when I say that.
Yeah.
So it takes some time to really, really be clear that what we're talking about is a system that can of ecological design that can work for the human beings and improve the lot of the other species and natural elements that we're in relationship with. And we're just not familiar with that culturally, quite frankly. We're just not comfortable with what it is to be in actual relationship with the environment. We're basically accustomed to being separate from it in our homes and in our businesses and, quite frankly, in our agriculture, being separate from it, and then visiting it in a sort of utopic ways and when we go out into the wilderness to camp.
Yeah.
But we don't have any, there's no functional livelihood relationship there. So there's this third area, and some people refer to it as the garden, quite frankly. Michael Pollan, who's an author I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with, Michael, or Pollan, I think, has written about this, this messy in-between area where where we have a relationship with nature, which is called the garden. How do we do that? How do we build our homes in such a way, grow our food in such a way that we're creating something that was neither a purely human-centered phenomenon, nor something which is purely wild and without human. It's a relationship between the two. And this is new territory for us as a culture. I mean, Certainly cultures in the past have been very adept at this, but we aren't. And it's something I think, it is something we need urgently to learn and apply every power of our society, including research and local government, in supporting. So that's what we're trying to do.
I'd have to say that living here on the Central Coast, as I have for 9 years, I have probably had more profound interactions with the natural world than I ever did when I lived in Phoenix, in the middle of the city. I've been on whale watching trips out in the channel and seen whales breaching. I've seen dolphins flying along with the boat. I've seen, the sea lions out there on the buoy, and obviously the seagulls and other fowl that are flying around along the beach and so forth and the wharf. I have actually had an experience with a brown bear up on the property where I live. We've had coyotes. We've heard them off in the distance. We've seen evidence of them outside our home. And I mean, it's just a small portion of some of the interaction that I've had specifically with the animals, let alone the plants. I mean, I have been blessed with being stricken with poison oak, which was not pleasant. Yeah. And now I understand it will be with me for the rest of my life, under control and maintained and not itching. But still, it's like once you get it, you will always have it. And I was real excited to hear that news. Learning about certain areas where there was just this incredible rich soil. And I mean, you could just smell the earth and it smelled so good. I mean, it smelled like dirt, but all I can say is something in my brain clicked and I'm going, oh, now that's a good dirt smell. I mean, that smells, and it was dark and rich and all. I mean, I'm experiencing some of these things as I'm living in this area, that again, people living in LA or Phoenix or other large metropolitan areas, they're not going to have unless they go to the forest. I don't know if you listen much to this station and some of the public service announcements that we play, encouraging people to go out to the woods, go to the forest and experience it, and so forth. And that's what we do. It's like going to the zoo, same kind of thing. I also want to talk about, when we come back from our break, I want to talk about the organization that you are a part of called SAMA, the SAMA Group, if I'm pronouncing that correct.
That's correct, yeah.
And I want to find out more about what that is what part it's playing and your role in that as well as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I certainly hope that you'll stay with us. We have a whole lot more to come. We're talking with Ben Werner. He is the creator, if you will, of the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, and we'll be right back.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I'm in the studio with Ben Werner, and we're talking about the Sustainable Living Research Initiative. And we're talking about ways in which we can better coexist. I haven't quite mastered the phraseology, as you've put it, but man-centered.
Human-centered ecological design.
Human-centered ecological what was the final word there?
Design.
Design. Okay. Speaking of design, you're involved with a group called Sama.
Yeah.
Sama Group, which is a design team and action network. Tell me what, first of all, what the word Sama means, and then about what you folks are, as it says here, what you're dedicated to.
Yeah. Thanks for asking us. The Sama Group is a unincorporated nonprofit that we created recently based on some of the work that we have been doing, including the Sustainable Living Research Initiative. And Sama is a Sanskrit root word that could be loosely translated to same or balanced or equal, coherent. And we chose the word Sama for Sama Group because it reflects really the core philosophy of our projects, which is creating or engendering or catalyzing or enabling balance and coherence in how we as a culture locally and hopefully beyond are living in relationship with each other, in relationship with natural systems. So that's what Sama means, and that's why we're called Sama Group.
And this group has been around how long?
Oh, not very long. I mean, we've been working on this for many years, but we only formally decided to call ourselves Sama Group maybe 2 years ago.
Okay. So that's not as much of a relevant factor as is the initiative, and I'm better understanding what this is all about, and it seems to me that over the course of time, I think there are going to be other like initiatives surrounding lifestyle. I have to say that one of the things that has kind of struck me about this whole process that we've been going through, I mean, I suppose we could say since the environmental movement sort of began here on the Central Coast in 1969, but more so here in the 21st century, where more and more people may not know how to live, quote unquote, the sustainable life.
Yeah.
Okay. But they want to, and they want to, and they know that it's going to change their lifestyle, the ways in which we've been living, aren't working for the earth. And even for us, because as you stated, on the one hand, you know, if we just continue to do whatever we want, we're going to cease to exist because we're going to destroy the ecosystems and we're not going to have what we need to sustain our lives. So the human race will just kind of disappear.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want that. What we do want, and what many people do want, is a way to, we're searching, and you're assisting us in that process, both through this initiative, and I'm sure through other, maybe not necessarily initiatives, but just getting us to think. I remember when we had, and I dovetail into this, we had Joe White from 2020, mm-hmm. A Year Without War.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the entire interview, I'm sitting there, you know, talking, well, peace is what you're talking about. And now, you know, all these different things. And he kept bringing it right back to, and I thought so appropriately so, and maybe in a sense, that's what you're doing as well, although you and your group are working actively with the various entities. But the bottom line was, he says, I just want people to start thinking, considering the possibility of what would that look like to you, a year without war? What would sustainable living look like to you if we keep going in that direction? Would we all be living in yurts? I mean, I was joking with someone this afternoon. I was joking with someone earlier that I says, I just want to hollow out the hillside and basically live in a cave, because it'll be plenty cool in the summertime because of the earth, and it'll be plenty warm in the winter.
Right. And you can do that effectively without necessarily digging a cave, but building with earthen walls. You can build with an adobe.
Now, some would say, I was going to say adobe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, or cob. And yeah, there's you know, great formulations of earthen materials. People in the art will know what I say when I mean cob, kind of adobe, that when done properly are very, perform very well in earthquakes, and obviously will not burn in fires, and are basically like having a cave in terms of the thermal mass of your structure and its ability to give you a stable temperature even while you're having summertime heat and wintertime cold outside.
Now, I'm sure you've been down to the Presidio a number of times. Yeah. I've been in there, and the walls are thicker than a human being, an adult male who's been working out. They're thicker. My father grew up in Coolidge, Arizona, and he grew up in an adobe home. And I still remember none of the windows had squared window frames, or I should say none of the window openings where the window frames were square, like you would see in a conventional wood, brick, or mortar house. They were all curved at the corners. They were all curved. Now, I know there's a name for that particular shape, but nonetheless, but that's what he grew up in. And I grew up with in a brick home with evaporative cooling. Now, the brick wasn't any thicker than the bricks we have today. But evaporative cooling, and as I was growing up, was quite efficient because during June and July, the humidity was way down. And as a matter of fact, I sometimes had to bundle up under the covers, even in June and July overnight, because the air coming out of those ducts in the ceiling was so cold because the humidity was so low. August kind of went to pot because the humidity went up, and so the evaporative cooling process didn't work as well. But we've been doing some of some of these things. I mean, I keep thinking about you mentioned adobe, and I keep thinking about, you know, it seems to me like, you know, how easy that would be to, you know, you just get, you know, you get yourself some an area where there's a lot of mud, you know, or a lot of dirt that you can turn into mud with a little water, some, maybe some straw or hay or whatever, you know, or some of the grasses. It could clear your land of all of the weeds and mix that into your mix, and then start making bricks, you know, maybe big ones and that kind of thing. Again, I know there's a process to it that I'm not aware of, but it just seems to me like, you know, in a way we're kind of missing the boat, because we could have some pretty nice structures, pretty nice living arrangements that are still very comfortable.
Definitely.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've seen a lot of pictures, and I've visited some places around the Central Coast where they have yurts. Some of them are very elaborate. I've actually watched on a video, I've watched them build one in less than a day, put it up. So I'm curious. You say you live in one.
I live in one. I'm not so much an advocate for the material that yurts are typically made of. I'm for this region, I'm more an advocate for the earthen and natural fiber-based building materials, everything from, you know, adobe to clay straw to straw bale. I think these are really the probably the most appropriate materials that I'm aware of for our area in terms of, you know, the net life cycle impact, carbon impact, and environmental impact, and just the living performance of these structures, both thermally, as we've been talking about, and ability to breathe moisture vapors, so you never have mold issues, for example. The fact that nothing eats them, termites included. They don't burn. I mean, inherently non-toxic. The list just goes on and on.
On the one hand, there's a part of me that's thinking, you know, a lot of this stuff is like a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we doing this now?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's almost an irrelevant question, because we are not doing that now. But we're starting to, more and more people, the consciousness is changing. We're starting to think more along these lines. And someone said to me, I should say Jack Reed, author of The Next Evolution, he said to me that this isn't about tearing down the old systems. For example, you're dealing with the various regulatory bodies to bring about this wonderful new sustainable living research initiative, and you're getting some great support through that process. But he made it very clear. He says, you don't go tearing down the old institutions, as it were. Mm-hmm. You build a new institution that's better than, that people are going to turn to. It's like you build a new and improved, and you build it and they will come.
I agree with Jack. And I would also add that you can do that with the pieces of the system that exists. In fact, you always do. You always use the parts that you have in front of you.
You never completely get rid of. Yeah.
Yeah. With anything you build, you start with something that's in front of you, with the parts that are in front of you. And that's, you know, I could argue that could be what we're doing here. If we, you know, if we create a pathway through current regulations for this, and this pathway becomes, if it were to become by far the most popular pathway for any new construction, well, you know, before long, it would become the new system, if you like. So that could be.
Absolutely. We're talking with Ben Werner. He's with the Sama Group, and he's also with the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, basically creating a model regulatory framework. And this is part of searching for those new ways of living. And quite honestly, I think it's become abundantly clear that we really need to do something. I even talk with people in regards to the whole, whether you want to call it climate change or global warming, and whether man has or has not had a contributing factor, whether he's sped it up or this is just natural cyclical process of the planet. I say, set that aside. Don't you think we should be doing these things anyway? Mm-hmm. Even if we weren't talking about those other issues that are extremely polarizing. Set those aside. Mm-hmm. This just seems to me like, and I'm very excited about the prospects.
Yeah.
In this regard.
Yeah, I think the intellectual arguments about carbon emissions and global warming, I think they have limited motivational power. I mean, we know them by now. You know, we get to feel guilty every time we turn on our ignition and go on a road trip, right?
Yeah.
Like, we know that, but there are visceral, what interests me personally a lot more than the intellectual sort of arguments about sustainability or carbon or the environment are really kind of the visceral emotional motivators that come out of direct personal relationship. And by that, I'm really talking about direct personal relationship with the environment. And one of my favorite examples of this, getting right down to a very practical example, is my composting toilet. So when I used to live in a conventional structure and I want to clean my toilet, I had no qualms about putting Clorox or, you know, whatever that green powder is, you know, in my toilet to clean it. Even though intellectually I know that, you know, it's not good for the environment. There are non-biodegradable things in there. But when I open up the inspection port in the earth of my composting toilet, I see thousands of beings in there. I see the earthworms that live in there and digest the poop that we flush down there every day. Mm-hmm. And I feel a personal affinity. Maybe I'm strange, but I feel a personal affinity for those beings. And the thought of pouring even a drop of poison down there, it's not even an idea. I cringe when I think about it. So I have never even considered putting a drop of bleach or something non-biodegradable, you know, down my toilet. And it's because I have this relationship, this direct relationship a few paces away from my toilet with the beings that are kind of like the complementary half of this little ecosystem where I am the other half. And together we make fertile soil, and banana trees, and in my case, that grow in that do very well, as you can probably imagine. So I think kind of the leading cultural edge that we're working with here with this initiative are the folks like myself, and I know we're not the majority, but I don't think we're an insignificant minority either, that are ready and willing and wanting to begin to develop their own personal relationships with the other members of the ecosystem. And as we develop, you know, just like I might be okay with the fact, you know, some people might be okay with the fact that we send bombs to other people's countries, we're not okay with bombs landing on our neighbors because we have relationships with our neighbors, because it creates a personal experience to us. We would never hurt anybody that we're in relationship with personally. And I believe we need to begin to recreate those relationships, or create them for the first time if we don't have any sense of them yet, with the natural environment around us that supports us, that feeds us, that provides us with clean water and so forth. And when those personal relationships are established, there is a natural aversion, not an intellectual aversion, but a natural instinctual aversion to harming them. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think that's really kind of at the emotional heart, I guess, of this initiative, is is how do we enable those relationships to happen for those, you know, in our community that are ready to exemplify that and be an example, be the, you know, be the cultural creatives, the leading, you know, the early adopters of this experience and this, you know, supreme environmental performance, if you like, that others will, I believe, will be inevitably drawn to. Any cultural shift, it begins with the early adopters, it begins with the minority, and if their new experiment is works well and is compelling and creates a better experience of life, then the bulk of the bell curve will inevitably follow, whether it's smartphones or recycling or composting or composting toilets. I mean, I believe the same basic dynamic of sociocultural change will apply. So,
yeah. For me, living up on the hill, my first thought is, would I do this if I lived below me? You know,
down the watershed.
Mm-hmm. You know, when it rains, would I flush my radiator out onto the ground if I lived below me? You know, would I run this pesticide over here to get rid of these weeds if I lived down below me? As a matter of fact, we, it sounds bizarre because we still have some of them, some of the gardening, chemicals that we brought with us from Phoenix, which we have never used. Why we brought them with us, I do not know. Why we still have them, I do not know, other than the fact that we haven't used them. And so I need to find an ecologically sensitive way of disposing of them. I need to find someone who will take them and do with them whatever needs to be done so that they're neutralized.
You can take them to the chemicals facility at UCSB on Saturdays, I think.
Oh, yeah. All right. So. Well, we'll exchange the addresses and all that stuff later. Yeah, yeah. But I think that's another thing too, is my wife and I, we're going through the process of going through corners of the house. I mean, we live in a two-room cottage. It's not like there's a lot of room, but yet we've managed to fill it with a lot of stuff. Yeah. I mean, we came here, and when we moved, they charge you by the pound of what you move. And we brought 9,000 pounds of stuff. Cost us, I think, $5,000. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, and we've honed down quite a bit. I still have one of the original, very large, and I say it's only 27 inches, but still, the unit is very large. One of the first HD TVs. That was not flat. Mm-hmm. It was deep, still had a tube in it. It doesn't work anymore, but I have it in my shed. I've got to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. And a couple of televisions that they don't work anymore, and some printers. And I know, again, there are the electronics collection by the local waste management company that will take those at certain times of the year, or I think you can take them right down to their central location in downtown Santa Barbara. But again, I think it's all about, you know, rethinking what we're doing and why. And each of us, it's like I tell people, I'm doing what I can in my little corner of the universe, you know. And when you think of it from a universal standpoint, it is a very small corner. But I'm doing what I can. And I'm not perfect. We're on septic, for example, septic system. And the most that... And I have to remind my wife from time to time not to put certain things into the toilet bowl, for example, for cleaning it. But we use that one product, as far as I've been able to research, that seems to be okay. This Ridex material, it's because it's it's enzymes. Mm-hmm. And it goes in there like the earthworms do for your composting toilet. They go in there and they eat up the waste that's in there, the solid material. And that's like, okay. And then apparently, and because I don't know that much about septic systems, I guess there are leach lines that come off of the tank for the liquid. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't build up and it goes back into the soil and so forth. But I don't have any, there's no odor. You know, I don't smell anything winter or summer, you know. I mean, unless it gets really warm, and then you kind of, if you get close to the lid, you know, out away from the house, the lid of the tank, you know, it may not be sealed 100%. So you get a little fumes, but it's nothing. It's not terrible. But I guess, you know, we're all trying to do something, you know. I don't know whether trading in my Volvo for a smart car or a hybrid, you know, or one of those electric carts. I don't know if you've seen, there's somebody that's driving them here downtown.
Yeah, there's a few in town, yeah.
And I think, okay, but I don't know if they'll make those up. I don't know if it'll make it up the pass. You know, kind of thing.
Maybe not.
It's one of the considerations. I've even jokingly said, you know, I wish they'd put in a zip line. Mm-hmm. You know, from the top down. I don't know how I'm going to get back up, but a zip line, and in 5 minutes or so, going down 2,200 feet down to sea level, that's a heck of a drop.
Provided you have a means to break, that could be real fun.
I was going
to
say, have to get a parachute or a sail or something to slow me down. But again, it's what's the phrase? Necessity is the mother of invention.
There's
and
that.
It's necessary for us now to really look hard at a lot of these things. I hear about, for example, fresh water. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of the program about rain and why we aren't collecting it before it runs off into the ocean, or why we aren't collecting it on our own properties, because it doesn't take much. I designed a 10 by 10 device that you can put up, in your yard to gather the rain when it rains, and then you fold it back up again and put it in your shed until it rains again. And you filled your tanks with whatever you fill. I mean, because every drop that you collect is a drop that you're not taking out of the public reservoir, whether you want to call it the lake, Kachuma, mm-hmm. or if there are the water treatment plant that pipes the water to the homes. If you're not taking it out of there and you're getting it from the rainfall, hey, fantastic. What was it back in the 80s, 70s or 80s? They actually talked about towing icebergs, you know?
Apparently it was considered by the city council.
I don't think they have to worry about that anymore because, I mean, I even saw a design for a desalinization device, not a plant, but a device that you actually moved out over the water. And it was designed to generate condensation that was channeled into a pipe that went to a tank or an offshore vessel of some sort, like mm-hmm. you would with oil. You do this with water. Mm-hmm. And you can move it around, and you're not going to be depleting the water. Of course, I know that there are other questions that need to be answered in that regard. And maybe that's another question I've got for you is, in terms of some of these ideas, how much research, R&D, do we need to do before we move forward? Because it seems like when it comes to modern living through chemistry, that process, it seems like R&D doesn't take long at all. I mean, they just whip it on through because it's quick, it's easy, and so forth. Whereas when it comes to these other processes for this sustainable living, the R&D goes on, and there's just, it's like, it's never ending.
I personally think that when it comes to understanding how we can live in mutually beneficial relationship with natural systems, mm-hmm. that research, that experiment, that will never end. I mean, anyone who's had a garden knows this.
Okay, but the experimentation,
you're never a perfect gardener.
All right, let's take the gray water issue.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, how tough is that? We use the wash water from our washing mm-hmm. machine right now to both water a very large pine tree mm-hmm. as well as a set of rose bushes that we've placed in a particular location distance away from the house. And it just goes into the ground, but they get the water and so forth. We use biodegradable soaps. Mm-hmm. So there's no damage.
Yeah. So gray water, for example, I would say that the practical on-the-ground understanding of how to do gray water well beneath the radar mm-hmm. Is pretty well developed at this point. Mm-hmm. But so it shouldn't take very long for legal systems, perhaps permitted under our initiative, to support the public research per se, or the bona fide research from catching up very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's not rocket science, but it takes some reasonable understanding of how soil works and how water flows subsurface and a little, and hopefully some understanding of how to plant a garden that will maximize the benefit of a gray water system.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, so there's definitely, from my perspective, a lot that we can do under this initiative that we actually know how to do pretty well from various circles. But bringing the hippies, so to speak, who've been doing this kind of thing beneath the radar, together with the university, together with our architects and our professional builders and local government, I foresee that we'll be doing things on a scale and at a level of impressiveness that we've never done before in this culture.
Well, I applaud you and both Sama and other folks that are involved in this initiative for the work that you're doing, because it's going to benefit us all down the road.
Thank you.
If it isn't already benefiting us in the here and the now. And I know it takes time. This is not something, and you're doing it in what I'm perceiving as a very gentle fashion. You're not trying to ramrod this through. It's not like we have a deadline and we've got to meet this deadline, because otherwise, you know, people talk about the tipping point. And,
it's a cooperative venture, let me put it that way.
Yeah. And it really has to be.
Yeah.
It really has to be. You want to do everything you can not to alienate people. You want to draw people in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah.
From both parties, mm-hmm. Hey, you don't have to leave your one or two, party one or party two. Mm-hmm. Just, again, I think it goes back to just consider what it would be like if we did these things. What a difference it would make,
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where... I'm beginning to be better educated in that regard as well, because I know that there are times when, I think about some of the things that are being done by the fringe element that says, I want nothing to do. I want to be off the grid, and I'm going to do these things whether they like it or not, because I can. And we need to start shifting, bringing them in so that they can understand. We understand your frustrations, and at the same time, you have to understand also that if we can make this happen so that you are now legitimized, what you're doing is legal, okay, hey, then so much the better. You're not going to have to worry about, one of the county vehicles showing up on your doorstep and saying you have to shut this down because you have no permits for it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to go through that.
It's very stressful.
Because then that becomes an adversarial type of relationship. Mm-hmm. And then we've kind of lost I don't want to say the war or the battle, but, we've kind of lost that cohesiveness that we're striving for.
I would call it infighting with respect to the real battle.
Okay, very good. The real battle is our survival.
Our survival as a species, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Ben, I really want to thank you so much for coming in studio and joining us here on the program and sharing with us these ideas. I think that they're fantastic. I think that there is hope for the future. I mean, I've raised the question on numerous occasions on this program. Do we really deserve to continue on with what we've done to the planet? And if we can...
We deserve to try.
Isn't it all about forgiveness? So we need to forgive ourselves and give it another shot and keep working at it. Keep working at it. Before I let you go, I want to ask you three more questions.
Sure.
Who is Ben Werner?
Ben Werner is a dedicated entrepreneur in sustainability. Is that the kind of answer you're looking for?
whatever answer you come up with is the answer I'm looking for.
All right.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I would like to, my vision of success is that I am personally living with a sense of security in my life, particularly my later years. And that security is based on a felt existence of mutual support between me, my community, and the natural resources that are supporting us. So it's a sense of security and support that isn't fully there yet. And I am hoping that my work will help build that for myself and for many others.
And who inspires you?
People inspire me who have single-mindedly devoted themselves to causes for the course of their lifetime and being willing to sacrifice anything for it.
Mm. Again, thank you so much for joining us. A reminder that if you would like to hear the entire interview, which is a little over an hour, then go to richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and you can listen to the entire interview, the radio program, as well as the afterview here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, love to Lal.